this is our April show, and we are a day or two late and many dollars short, but we have a couple of new members that we'd like to introduce to everyone here, and what I'll do is I'll pass the mic to you guys and let you talk about your show and give the audience a little bit of a taste of what they can expect from you, and then we'll just get into some organic discussion based on whatever you guys feel is relevant going on in the news or, you know, updates on shows. We have some things we can talk about from our show, the Actual Anarchy Podcast, and the Last Nighters, which is our normie-friendly version. But this is our monthly roundtable discussion of the LibertarianUnion.com members. We have over a dozen shows now. The newest members are Stephen Clyde of the Peace and Liberty Podcast and Nick Bacone. Am I saying that right?
Yeah, good job.
And yours is Sounds Like Liberty, is that correct?
That is correct.
All right, and you are, in fact, the very newest member. I don't even have your page posted yet, so hopefully I'll get that up in the next day or two, phrasing. But why don't we pass the mic to you, and you can just introduce your show, where can people find it, what you do on there, and you know, what's your target audience and all that stuff, and then we'll pass it on to Stephen from you.
Well, Sounds Like Liberty, you can find us at soundslikelibertypodcast.com. We started the podcast in an effort to kind of humanize people in the liberty movement was the real goal. I got sick of having arguments about Yemen and Syria with people and just talking policy nonstop, so I wanted to make us be actual people, I guess. And my favorite thing to talk about is music. So I figure I'd bring some libertarians on, we can talk about music, introduce people to new music, and try and connect on something other than just the politics side of things. I host it with my wife, Lizzie, and I think we generally sometime middle of the week every week, and if I have an interview, we'll post them on Saturdays. Oh, man. Is there anything else I should mention on there? That was my kid.
No, that's cool. This is live, people, so, you know,
yeah.
Life happens. Well, thank you for that, Nick. And, Stephen, you're the other newest member, or second newest member, so why don't you tell us where people can find your show, and what do you do, and how often do you do it, and, you know, give us all the gory details.
Well, I'll just say it's awesome to be a part of the Libertarian Union, just a group of people where we can all support each other, everything we all do. My name is Stephen Clyde. I host the Peace and Liberty podcast. I dedicate my life to talking about liberty and spreading the message of liberty. Really can't imagine myself doing anything else at this point. You can find me at forpeaceandliberty.com. I'm on iTunes, Stitcher. I'm on pretty much like everywhere now. If there's somewhere I'm not, just let me know and I'll get it up there. But yeah, I just live my life to spread peace and liberty.
All right, and if I recall, you are on a weekday basis, right? Like 5 days a week?
I do 5 days a week. People call me crazy, but the truth is I plan far ahead, and it goes pretty well. I mean, I'm already like 3 weeks to a month in advance, and I have plenty more people I could book, so I could almost do 7 days a week. I chose to do 5 days a week because I actually do have that much to talk about. I think
not a lot of current events.
Yeah. Or sometimes I just want to talk about a Rothbard book. Like I just finished up the other day, finishing up Anatomy of the State. I went through every single chapter of that. So people that can watch those few episodes have like taken a huge mental leap. Because Anatomy of the State, that's exactly what you get out of that. Like it's the red pill of red pills.
All right. Very good. Well, I was fortunate enough to be your very first guest. So that's episode 2, and people can find that where at 4peaceandliberty.com/2, the number 2.
I hope that link will work. I don't know if I have my link set up like that, but yeah, episode 2.
All right, do that. It makes it so much easier.
It might
when you
be
want
like
talk
that.
About
I'm just not sure. That's a good question.
All right, I just do it as redirects in my Bluehost control panel. So I can show you how to do it at some point. But so Nick is here, Stephen is here, and so is my co-host Robert. So Robert, how are you? And would you mind maybe telling our audience a little bit about what we've been doing on our show lately? Any updates, any changes, or anything else?
Hey, everybody. This is Robert from the Actual Anarchy Podcast and the Last Nighters Podcast, which is the normie-friendly version of the show. And what have we been doing? What is new, Daniel? We've just been doing the same stuff.
That's very compelling content there, Robert. If that's any indication of how great our show is, everyone should check it out. You can find our show at actualanarchy.com or lastnighters.com. So the Last Nighters version, like Robert was saying, is the normie-friendly version. It is relatively new. We've talked about it a little bit before on the Libertarian Union, State of the Libertarian Union talk show, which is what we're doing right now. I think that the most recent thing is we've been talking about maybe scheduling episodes a little bit further out. Like Stephen was talking about how he gets like 3 or 4 weeks ahead. We should be able to pick out movies a few weeks ahead while still having, you know, some room for updates and whatnot. But
I just want to praise one thing for you guys, Dan. I'm an anarcho-capitalist all the way down the line. You all are able to find anarchist elements that I would have never ever thought of in certain types of movies. So I do praise you guys for that. You guys do think outside of the box, especially when you guys are arguing with each other. It's great.
Oh yeah, those are our best episodes when we
disagree. Go watch the Lion King one. Yeah, you guys.
Yeah, Robert not a fan of the Lion King.
I just thought you were trying to pick fights directly with me.
Well, we're going to get to that one, Nick.
Hatred.
Yeah, we'll get to that one, Nick. So I think that's all the members we have today. Invalid Beard from Don't Waste Your Hate might chime in a little bit later, but everyone else had other prior obligations, so you're stuck with just us in our menage a trois here. So, Nick, since you chimed in and we're going to pick on you, you listened to our most recent episode, which was on Hot Fuzz, the Simon Pegg movie, and I think that episode is 74, so that can be found at actualanarchy.com/74. Or the normie-friendly version at lastnighters.com/17. So you had some commentary, and we would like to retort. But why don't you remind us of tell the audience what you saw and what you commented.
All right. So, I mean, obviously, huge fan of the show. But aside from that, you guys get this weird thing about cops where you really zone in, and while I understand the passion about that angle, I think you give way too much credit for the glorification of cops. Because in both episodes, I mean, let's be honest, they didn't exactly paint the cops in Super Troopers as being the smartest of the bunch. They clearly were denigrating the profession as a whole, saying this is the quality of human beings that's drawn to this. Now, the big thing with the Hot Fuzz angle was that for me, the whole arc of the movie is that he starts out as the super cop, and by the end of it, he realizes that the law itself isn't near as important as the protecting the people and actually being for the community, because if he was doing all the things that he was supposed to according to the law and the people there, he would have been sucked into the whole, you know, the bigger element, the deep state of the little town, so to speak. And so to me, it looked like the law was less important to him as opposed to being an ethical person within the community by the end of it.
Well, now that's an interesting point you bring up, but I'm curious because his only beef with those people was the fact that they were breaking the law. Now, are you saying that he went outside the law to bring them in or to capture them or something like that?
Well, no, I'm thinking of it more as in the way that he interacts as a person past that part. Because you can see how he's interacting in like the after the town has kind of reset in the way he's policing thereafter. It seemed to me to be less of a super cop mentality and more of a, all right, let's be a real person dealing with other people. Which is part of what Nick Frost's character in it helped to bring out in him. And it could just be that that's what I infer from the character because that's what I want to see. That's the way I remember the movie.
I will say he did take a vigilante bit or bent in his arming himself like Rambo and then going around doing, distributing justice upon these murderers in this cult. And so that probably wasn't like totally by the book, so to speak. So I will grant you that, but I think his arc, other than that, was pretty much the same. I mean, there isn't a whole lot of after story, right? Like, once the the main violence is done at the end, there's the he brings flowers to a grave, and then it's revealed that it's his partner who's not dead, and it's his mom's grave. But that's all we really see at the end. So I don't see him discovering ethics or
peel away for a call or something after the end of it.
Yeah, there's a property rights issue where some people are like loitering in a store or something like that, and then they peel away, like it's like the hottest call ever.
Yeah, which seemed to me like to be another instance of, well, he's going to be a human being here as opposed to Nick. Him at the beginning of the movie would have absolutely been, well, no, we have to drive the speed limit to get there and pass lanes, only doing this and this and this and this. I guess to me, he just became more human as it went on, and the law became less important.
Okay, well, for me, that says to me, that very end where he starts peeling away, that says more to me that his partner's influence had a bigger effect on him, and he became more of I'm Rambo, I'm action hero guy. Look at all I accomplished with all my action heroics.
See, that's how ANCAP I am. I just saw what I wanted to see.
It's all subjective, man.
It is. It is art, and it is all subjective, and that's why it can be fun to talk about, though.
Yeah, I will say that he seemed to be having more fun at the end in that brief moment there. So maybe they did humanize him in a way, because early on in the movie, when he is super cop, he lacks social skills to such an extent. Like, all of his relationships are totally stunted, right? Everyone hates him, but he has, like, no clue. You know?
Very libertarian in that way.
Yeah, I feel his pain, right?
Yeah.
All right.
He wants to talk about the law.
That's all he wants to talk about ever.
Oh, yeah. I'm sure Patrick would know exactly what we're talking about here, because I think he gets in trouble at home for only talking about libertarianism in the home.
Uh-oh.
Sorry, man. Calling you out, buddy. Next time, be on the show so you can defend yourself.
Man, I just wanted to say one thing. I don't know how many shows you guys have done. The one time I finally get on, there's only like two of you guys. And I was expecting like a group of like 10 people today, so man.
Hey, maybe next time, all right? You make me feel
bad. I'm calling everybody out who wasn't here.
I can run my mouth for six if you want me to.
Oh, I guess I could too.
Since we're sort of on the topic of the UK, and the UK's been in the news a lot lately, I'm wondering if I could pitch a question over to you, Stephen. Mm-hmm. We've seen marches against knives and binning knives. We've seen several medical issues being untreated, people denied surgeries for being obese and smoking, children being left to starve to die with dignity, things like this. So let's just start trashing the UK a little bit, if you're game.
Oh, I mean, we could just talk about the Alfie Evans case. I mean, that was one of the most despicable things that's probably going to happen this year. I don't know if you guys realize what happened near the end there. The judge ruled that, well, they took the kid off the ventilator, and basically what happened is the kid kept breathing. I think they were taking the kid off the ventilator just thinking the kid would die. And by the way, this hospital was well guarded with like these military type people, because people were going crazy, like they wanted to save that kid. So they took the kid off the ventilator, still breathing for like 24 plus hours. Italy offers to fly the kid over for free to try another experiment. Judges say nope. So kid dies. I don't know if you guys heard, kid died. It was like last night or two nights ago. Real sad. The parents were completely helpless. I wrote an article about this, and I'm waiting for Liberty Hangout to publish it. Hopefully they'll publish it by tomorrow. But one thing I point out is that you can read the whole judge's ruling, and it's kind of sick. And then they're kind of saying, like, you know, the reason we're doing this is because we want to protect the autonomousness of the kid. Just crazy. It doesn't even make sense. So the kid's only autonomous if he's in the hands of the state where they kill him. It was murder. I mean, Italy was asking to fly him over for free. They were going to try free treatment. They were just like, don't let the kid die. We'll try something else. it's like unbelievable, right? So, I mean, we're just talking about a bunch of evil psychopaths.
Well, their logic was in both of the cases, because this is the second one within a year, correct, that the UK has had. And their reasoning was that the kid's going to die anyways, and you're harming him by prolonging his life.
Yeah, that's basically the logic. But you know, the point is that a lot of brain dead patients come back, and I have this one article linked to the article I wrote in the footnotes, and it just goes, you know, some of these cases are basically like people have like neurodegenerative diseases, and they wake up from it right before their organs are about to be harvested, and this happens time and time and time again. So I really don't trust the ruling on these things to say that, you know, we're 100% sure this is the case. That baby may have well been able to be saved, and it was almost 2 years old. I think a few days, almost 2 years
old. Let's do a crossover with you in Actual Anarchy. They should totally do the movie Awake, where the guy is being operated on while he's conscious.
Oh, is that like locked in,
like a horror movie?
Kind of stuff?
I think it was a suspense movie. I think it was like espionage involved. He's like a 19-year-old kid. Like, I think he was wealthy, and they tried to kill him, but he didn't die. You should look into it. It's a real weird movie. Might it even almost, end up at foreign.
It almost sounds like Get Out a little bit.
There's a certain element of that in there, but about 10 years prior.
There's another movie with Ryan Reynolds, and he's like buried alive in this casket, and all he has is a cell phone and a lighter. So a lighter to see, and like the cell phone, and like these people call him saying like they set him up. I forget what movie it is. I don't know how we got on this topic, by the way. We're talking about dead kid in the UK.
I just thought it was a good crossover of people being declared dead.
Yeah. Well, just to bring it back, I mean, universal healthcare is just deadly in itself. And this is kind of an example, because when you give government the power to have the final say, it might be you as the parents watching your kid basically suffocate and starve to death. I think it was basically it was both starving and suffocating to death, because the kid was taken off the ventilator but still breathing. Not to say the kid was breathing good, the kid was just still breathing. So.
Well, and you might know more than this. I'd heard that they'd actually stopped feeding the kid at the hospital because he didn't die.
Yeah.
Which I can't even fathom. Like, you have this person that's living and capable of doing this, and you're refusing to do it?
Yeah,
unconscionable.
This is kind of related to the Terry Schiavo case. This was back a few years ago, or a long time ago now. It was like 13 years ago now. It was in 2005 when she was taken off her feeding tube for the third time, court-ordered. Michael Schiavo wanted her to stay on the feeding tube, and her parents didn't. And you know, that's kind of a moot point, because like the whole point is that the government was in control of like whether she had the feeding tube in or out. You know, they were in control of it all. So she died under that condition. And Terry Schiavo, there was like a group of like missionaries or Christians that were trying to go in there to feed her, and they got in huge trouble. So yeah, in this case with Alfie Evans, their parents or this group that was wanted to go in there and help them, they got denied to do that. Mm-hmm. So it's just a really common theme you see, and like all these. That's one reason I like to talk about history. It's just so people realize, like, okay, that thing that happened in 1896, it happened today. You know, all this stuff is just history does repeat itself. It's kind of like a sick joke.
Hey, Stephen, do you recall the other child? Was that Charlie Gard? Is that how his name was spelled or said?
Yeah.
What happened with him? He wanted to come to the United States, or his parents wanted to bring him to the United States for some experimental. Procedure that might have been able to prolong his life, but
yeah.
They were also denied bringing him over. Is that correct?
That sounds about right. That was a while back, but gosh, it's just crazy. Can you imagine like someone's offering to save your life? They're gonna do it for free. All they're asking is that you give up custody of the dying person. And what's the sense of it? Because obviously, in like the judge's mind, they think they're being humane. Obviously, to everyone else, they're absolutely inhumane. Those parents have to live with that the rest of their lives. Like, their whole legacy is their child was killed by the UK. That's your whole legacy now.
The bigger thing is the implications from, like, the response that the police had. Like, literally putting out threats about it. Like, threatening, saying, if you try and come here, we will react accordingly. Like, I can't imagine parents being in that frame of mind and then saying, and hey, if you have anybody try and come here, we're going to arrest you and we're going to throw you in a cage. And that's what you get for trying to protect your child.
Well, I think the scary part is if they did take action, it would be in their best interest to hide whatever happened. Because imagine like some old grandmother walked in with a plate of food and tried to feed him and they shot her down. Would they really want to report that?
Well,
I don't think they would want to report that.
The thing is that they were even making threats about people talking about it on Twitter specifically. Hmm. Like, they were going to use the hate speech laws that they have in place to go after people, you know, targeting it.
Yeah.
Yeah, talking about perversion of that. Robert, I think you were trying to chime in.
That's exactly what I was going to mention. It's just that it goes beyond even their violence of them stopping anybody trying to help this child and declaring that they essentially own this child.
Yeah, that's the best way to word it. You know, they essentially own the child now.
Yeah, you know, I know if I stopped feeding my kid, I would get in some shit, right? I would get in trouble with the authorities. So when the authorities do it, it's fine.
Just use the excuse that you just didn't want your child to suffer. You're just letting him starve.
Right. Now, I want to...
That's the same argument that the UK used. Yeah, we feel bad for the kid. Let's just let it die.
Well, my kids aren't suffering, though. But I want to bring this to some Rothbard, because Rothbard argues, I believe, that you have no positive obligation, including feeding your own child. Now, I think that this is an area where Rothbard isn't quite right. I think that if you have custody and have taken on the responsibility of bringing another life into the world, you have to see that they have their needs provided for them while they're unable to do so on their own, or you need to find a caretaker in your stead. Otherwise, you are neglecting your duty, right? Your diligence of you've brought something into the world, a human being, even if it was an animal, I think that you'd, you know, bear some responsibility for bringing something into your care and then starving it. You know, I think that there's some harm there.
I think Walter Block updated a lot of Murray's views. Like, Murray was pro-choice. I think Walter is evictionist views. Like, I think Murray would be like, yeah, that's the correct view. But yeah, related to this, I think Walter Block has a more updated view, basically that you can't improperly homestead. So just forget children for a sec. Just talk about property. I can't take 100 acres and homestead it in a donut and leave, like, you know, 50 square acres in the center, because that'd be improperly homesteading it. You're like restricting access to, you know, homesteadable land. It's like, you know, there's like a proper way of homesteading. Like, you do have to, like, put your labor into the soil, like do something to it, put something on top of it, water the grass, mow the grass, put a mailbox there, whatever. So related to children, yeah, if you bring a child into the world, I don't think you have a positive obligation to feed it, but I think I wouldn't even call it a positive obligation. It'd be affecting the child's negative rights to have somebody else in the world that would inevitably want to come and take care of that child. You know, if there was a news report that came out saying, like, you know, Dan is letting his child starve, What's the chance that child would actually starve? I mean, people would rush to the house, police would rush to the house. It wouldn't last for a second. So I think Walter Block's point is much more updated and sound. What would you guys say?
Ooh, Roger Paxton actually had some interesting stuff on this week's episode that I'd never thought about. In particular, he was talking about child abuse and how do you handle that in an ANCAP society. And, you know, the idea being that, well, I think he's correct. Like, if you give every person their own, you know, their own inalienable rights, whatnot. Then, if a community sees a child not being properly taken care of, then that parent is in itself actually violating the child's rights and has a right to liberate the child from the improper care. Basically,
yeah.
You're treating it as a slave, and it's not a slave; it's a human being.
Yeah,
so.
Look. If I take my 18-year-old child and I put him in a corner and I prevent him from leaving the world, I won't tell anybody else that he's sitting there starving and I'm holding him there. Well, it's the same logic when you apply it to a child, except obviously an adult is going to be conscious; they're going to know how to escape. A child is just kind of really helpless. So I think, especially for a child, if you don't want to take care of the child, you have to tell somebody. And I wouldn't consider that a positive obligation. That's just respecting the negative rights of the child.
Exactly.
Because I think the child does have negative rights. I think everyone has negative rights. What do you think about that, Dan?
Yeah, I think we're ham-fisting our way through it fairly well. I want to say that, you know, I can't morally starve my kids because I brought them into this world, and I have agreed, even if it's implicitly, to take care of them, to provide for them. And until they are capable of doing it their own, on their own, or if I choose not to, then I need to make them available for someone else who's willing to do it. Because, you know, there is charity in the world, there is compassion in the world, people would be stepping up to that, and I would be preventing that, and mm-hmm. thus causing them, you know, significant harm, if not death, similar to what happened in UK.
And the point is that Rothbard was right. Look, he was right, but the point is he didn't extend the thought far enough. He said you don't have a positive obligation to feed your child. That's true. There is a negative obligation there to let someone else know. I think Rothbard was right. I just want to make that clear. I think Rothbard was right. I don't believe in any positive obligation in the world. But I think, you know, you can choose not to feed your child, but there are a million other people who would want to feed that child. And improperly homesteading that child.
All right, so I want to shift it back a little bit.
Oh, okay.
Or Robert, you want to? Yeah, go ahead and chime in, Robert, and then I'll shift it.
Well, I was just going to ask Stephen if he then believes or does not believe in, then when you create a child, are you in fact essentially forming a contract or not?
Well, that's a good question. I'd have to think on that for a second. I don't know what my immediate response would be. I'll come back to that.
Okay. Go ahead, Daniel.
All right. So I wanted to shift it back to the medical side of things because the doctors in the UK and the court was making a decision based on medical experts, you know, the technocrat, right? The technocratic progressive ideal. Well, I have a couple of examples. One personal, and then the other is statistically. And the statistic is, I believe that medical malpractice and inappropriate, you know, medical procedures, accidents, overprescription, etc., is responsible for upwards of six figures of deaths per year. You know, like over 100,000. So these are doctors doing medical advice, medical procedures, prescribing things, and killing patients. And they have every incentive, the government and whoever's collecting these statistics, to like try to minimize this, because it's, you know, it's an indictment of their what they're providing. And Steven, you talked about this and on Facebook recently in a post about Venezuela, how people are starving, but the doctors can't write down that they're starving, so they have to call it something else.
It's hard to know how long it's been going on for, too. That's just
right.
Something I was reported kind of recently, yeah.
And so I chimed in on that, and I was like, well, that's how Cuba got their first world infant mortality rates, you know, the super low infant mortality. They just started calling it something else. So, you know, taking that into consideration, I would think that the medical malpractice and the accidental deaths is related to that would have a tendency to be underreported, yet the numbers are still huge, still significant. So that's strike one against experts, right? Like, they're not always right. Now, my personal example is my cousin. He had a genetic condition in his brain that didn't reveal itself until he was like 12 or 13 years old, and a blood vessel popped in his brain. He had an aneurysm. He was in a coma. They said he would never wake up. And if he did, he'd be a vegetable. Well, after like 40 days, he finally woke up. And since then, he has recovered to the point where he has probably 80% functionality on one side of his body and like 20 or 30% on the other. He's went on to graduate from college. He has a master's degree. He has a, you know, a job. He's living on his own. Like, he wasn't even supposed to live, right? All the experts were saying he's not going to wake up. He's going to die. And if he does wake up, he's going to be a vegetable. So just one, you know, one example, and then the statistics of hundreds of thousands of deaths related every year to experts getting it wrong. And so then when experts in a socialized healthcare system in the UK are relying on other experts to say, oh, this kid's not going to make it, therefore we're being compassionate by starving him to death. It doesn't make a whole lot of sense to me.
Man's hubris, man. That's all that is.
Yeah, I'll go to Nick.
Every angle of it. It's just man's hubris.
Yeah, sorry, I didn't end that with going to someone. But
Robert, anyway. I have an answer to your question now. So you asked when a woman's impregnated, has she formed a contract? And I guess my first question would be, isn't any legitimate contract, aren't you able to back out of it so long as there are valid ways to break out of a contract and invalid ways. For example, I have a lease with my apartment. I could break that lease. It'd probably cost me a fee, but I can legally do that. That's a valid way to break a contract.
I have altered the deal.
Yeah, I guess the question is, when you're impregnated as a woman, do you have this contract that you can no longer break, or is this a contract you can get out of? My first response would be, well, if the mother's dying, I think most reasonable people would agree that she was here first, and her life would be valued first. So I think in that sense, you're ending the contract to bring this kid into the world, save the mother. So there is some type of valid way to break this contract. Now, maybe an invalid way to break this contract would be, you know, to give birth to the baby and, like, toss it off a rooftop or, you know, 10 minutes before the baby comes out, you know, like, shoving, like, a needle in its eye. Or, you know, you could think of any situation. But I guess go ahead.
So you are agreeing that you form a contract, though. That was my initial question.
Well,
that's debatable because if I can get out of the contract, then I can make the argument that there never was a contract, right?
Not necessarily. Not if there are, you know, certain requirements for escape.
I guess my question, Robert, would be who is the contract with, because the child is incapable of forming a contract. I know Walter Block absolutely, this all figures into his evictionism as to what he feels on it. I'm at a loss. I can't remember exactly what his explanation was, but I believe his point was because there's no way for the child to form a contract, there is no contract. And that's why until the child is able to be removed viably, there you're not really at fault as far as things go.
Yeah, and like viability is kind of because that's the only way you can compromise. The point of evictionism is like it's the only type of compromise that ever exists in the whole abortion argument. That no matter what, you're at least satisfying half of what someone wants, right? You're at least admitting that if the child is not viable, then you're evicting the child. But if it is viable, it's murder. It is murder to kill a child 7th, 8th, 9th month when you take. You know, Ron Paul talked about this once in the debate years ago. He talked about how he saw a baby being born and they tossed it in a bucket and the baby was breathing, crying, and the baby just kind of like suffocated. You know, it was just a matter of time. So obviously that'd be kind of sickening. I wouldn't want to see that. So, yeah, I'm personally pro-life. Like, you know, if I get a girl pregnant, like I'm gonna want to keep that kid. That's my personal decision. That's something I can choose to do all my whole life. I hate using a leftist talking point, but it is true that if you ban abortions, you will get clothes dryer, or what's the analogy?
Clothes hanger.
Yeah, the clothes hanger type abortions, but.
Quick straw poll. How many guys here are pro-life?
Anytime you make anything illegal, the quality decreases.
Yeah. My argument is I don't think the government can manage anything, 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 so that includes abortion.
Right.
So I could be personally pro-life and just say, like, the government, there's no possible way they could regulate this out of existence.
Certainly not, for sure. I'm 100% in agreement with you there. And Daniel and I had a really long discussion on how exactly you would stop abortions from happening.
Yeah, what would you be willing to do to stop it in Ankapistan, right?
It's like, how do you stop people from doing heroin? It's not that far off. You can't really. Some people are still going to do it. And it's a matter of when they do it, are they going to be buying it in the back street and shooting something into their arm they don't know what it is? Or is it going to be done and, you know, whether it offends people? It would offend people, heroin being sold at 7-Eleven. But it would offend others for there to be legal abortions, so.
It used to be sold at the corner grocery store, or at least at the pharmacist back in the day, before it was made illegal.
I saw this funny picture the other day. I don't know if this was a real picture. It's a picture of the Grim Reaper, and he has a sign saying, I stand with Planned Parenthood.
Yep.
Is everybody here pro-life out of curiosity?
I don't know what to call myself. I'm pro-choice, but pro-life. Like, in my own personal life, I would want the girl I am pregnant to keep the kids. Anyone else that gets them pregnant, literally anyone else, pro-choice. I don't know what to call that view.
I think it's – my personal view is that I believe it's immoral if you voluntarily get pregnant and then you terminate the pregnancy. And by voluntarily get pregnant, I mean you have sex and you get pregnant. I think that's –
yeah.
And go ahead and kill that baby. I think that's immoral. But I'm not going to advocate any violence to be used to stop that person from getting an abortion.
Based on the science I've seen, I'm pro-abortion – up until after 6 months after it's born, essentially. At which point it actually develops consciousness. It doesn't have until that point. I believe 6 months is about when it starts being able to delineate itself as something that's not just part of the world around it.
Wait, did you say 6 months after being born?
I'm surprised when nobody gave me any pushback on that real quick. From the science I've seen, it takes about 6 months before a child actually is able to even differentiate itself from the world around it. You don't have a consciousness until that point. So,
well,
that's kind of always how I've justified it to myself that I'm pro-choice. And besides, consciousness isn't all it's cracked up to be. I kind of wish somebody had done that to me. All this stupid stuff.
The prefrontal cortex doesn't fully develop until you're 25, so up until that point, you're not necessarily fully conscious either. So,
like,
you're all at 25?
All right, no offense, but Nick, you're over 25, right? So I guess murdering you at this point would be wrong?
And I'm completely willing to be changed on it, but the understanding I had was that, I mean, if you're not even capable of differentiating yourself from your surroundings, you're kind of just part of the ether anyways. I understand if you have a religious reason for not believing that, and I'm okay with that. That's completely someone's right to do it. I don't have the religious tie to it. So for me, from a strictly science standpoint and to my understanding of consciousness, that is where I would draw my line. Now, I don't also imagine that anyone is going to post-birth abort a child. That doesn't sound like anything anyone would actually do. I know.
Hey, wait,
that...
wait. Hang on, Nick. So,
okay.
So you're saying that you don't have negative rights until you have consciousness. Is that correct?
Okay, let me interject here because I have a good argument. I make this argument a lot. Libertarianism is not an ideology for whales. It's not an ideology for insects. It's an ideology for human adults. I do believe in non-aggression against everybody, but I think as a philosophy, it's describing human adults and human action, right?
And the one caveat that I would say, I think I know where you're going, Robert, is that it can't be something that has reached consciousness and lost it, which would be like someone in a coma would be, for instance. If you're a thing that has never had consciousness, that is a different thing than someone who's had it and lost it.
Exactly.
Because so potential consciousness doesn't matter to you as long as it hasn't happened yet?
That's basically where I would personally draw my line. But as I said before, I also, in practical terms, can't see any human being actually making that decision. Having gone through a birth myself, like I find it difficult to imagine that after a certain point of the preparation and the birth, even prior to having a kid, I can't see somebody actually following through on that. But just to give a really, really hardcore interpretation.
Do it. Give me the hardcore.
if nothing else, I should get some hate mail out of it.
Yeah, so Nick is our newest member of the Libertarian Union and our shortest tenured member who has been evicted, so to speak.
William Henry Harrison. Libertarian Union.
I'll get my fame however I get it.
Well, that's how you get it, man. Don't make those extreme comments. You know, I thought we were pretty extreme. And I think for the most part, you know, like, among the normie crowd, I think that that we would be considered extreme. And that's one thing that really bothers me, is that why do people who advocate for voluntary interaction and no third-party intervention, why are we the crazy ones? Steven, why are we the crazy ones?
Well, it's because we actually take a principled position, and that everyone else's positions are specifically unprincipled, but they find comfort in that. They like that. They know that's the norm.
It's a lot easier.
Well, holding principles is not easy and requires a lot of thought. Let's be honest, it's way easier to watch the Kardashians than think about shit.
I mean, or tick a box.
It seems like it'd be both. Like, it seems like, most people aren't libertarians. Most people don't talk about the non-aggression principle. It's not that obvious they'd figure that out. But at the same time, I think it's probably like the easiest thing in the world to understand. Like, you know, we're in a room together. Don't hurt one another. Just talk to each other if you want to, or don't talk at all, or move on, move along. And I think from our perspective, it's the most simple thing in the world, but it's like an oversimplified idea, like, don't touch me, like, what?
I blame it on Dungeons and Dragons.
That's too simple. What does that even mean?
I think it's all D&D's fault in my case. I like rules.
What did D&D do to you? Oh,
that's why I decided to die.
I like rules. Very, very specific, and everybody follows the same one.
I think Rothbard was a fan of Risk, and that's funny because Rothbard's like this. He hates government altogether, but he likes this, like, taking over the world game.
Well, it does teach strategy. I mean, games like chess and Risk, they do.
I've never played Risk. I heard it takes a long time to get through one game.
Yeah.
Depends which model, which version.
Yeah.
All right, so let's explore this, the depth of the dungeon here, Nick, because I think that you've got a fellow nerd on the other line there. Let's get into Dungeons and Dragons and what libertarian information we can glean from that.
Well, my point was that I was strictly making is perhaps I'm drawn to it for the same reasons as the other thing. Like, when more normal people play Monopoly, which has very, very simple rules that are kind of...
A central bank.
Malleable, yeah, obviously. I liked the complexity of just reading, 30 books just to understand the core of what the game is. And
so have you?
I think it's the same impulse that got me there is what got me to libertarianism. I mean, there's this really complicated thing that explains everything in the universe? Yeah, let's read about that.
So have you ever rolled a lawful good character?
It would be an interesting character to play, and then a terribly boring game at that.
All right, and the newest member has joined us.
Where's Mama?
Oh, this is a new member.
Where's Mama?
You want to wave her?
Who's that on the line?
Looks like a rugrat.
What's that?
Hi to who?
I'm talking to you. Can you go upstairs? I'll give him a little bit. I'll be sleeping.
You know, my kid thinks that everyone has a podcast, and so she wants to start one.
Yeah, she's been begging to be on my podcast forever, but I think she's too shy.
Yeah,
she's confusing me the one that actually have a camera.
Does she know she's on right now?
You know you're on camera, right, Irma?
Hi.
Did you just clam up really bad?
I'm so. Oh, I don't know how to make a podcast.
Come here, sweetie.
Neither do we.
Yeah, don't worry, kid. We don't either.
Yeah, we suck at this.
You run upstairs?
We don't make any money.
Is it on there? Well, apparently, I have at least a viewer. I'll try to keep her quiet.
All right, no problem. All right, so Robert, you want to flex your nerd cred on the D&D?
Nah, I don't really have a whole lot of points to make. I'm sure there are things to talk about, but one thing you said earlier kind of had me thinking just a little bit. I try not to think too much, but you were mentioning how the opioid crisis and the false prescriptions or over-prescribing things. And the incentive to overprescribe things, ends up killing people. But you don't actually attribute any kind of culpability to these doctors, do you, for these opioid deaths? Because ultimately it is a personal choice to take these medications. You're just acting under advice.
Has anybody in here read Bob Murphy's Primal Prescription by chance?
Yeah, I haven't read it all the way. I have it.
It gets into dieting stuff halfway through it, but there's a lot of really interesting stuff as far as like the pharmacy industry and the way that the testing is done on all that. That does kind of, to me, lend some insight as to why things are really, really messed up and how we regulate that side of things.
Like billions, billions.
When he starts getting into starts getting into the NNT and NN. The NNT stuff is what really gets crazy.
What's that?
The way basically it boils down to the numbers and how you actually, how many people have to take this for it to actually heal somebody, or how many people need to take it to actually harm them.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, it's just healthcare is so screwed up right now. I mean, the whole system. I mean, it's obvious that the way the system is now, the only incentive you're supposed to have is to get in the doctor as many times as you can, go get as many trivial checkups done as you can, take as many free things as you can, but there isn't really an incentive to just allow the life-saving drugs to pass through, and the FDA just keeps all these life-saving drugs from hitting the market. And yeah, it's just from start to finish, you know, just getting the research and development money together. Ultimately, when these drugs do go out, the doctors, you got to think in an environment where a doctor, they got to try to get people through as quick as possible, because if everyone's coming in with this insurance care, that, you know, everyone has it, everyone can come get a checkup whenever they want. You have to get people in and out, in and out, in and out, in and out, all day. So you don't really take care of them like you would in a private scenario where, like, you actually pay for a service and you get the real treatment. So, yeah, I mean, the doctors don't really know much about the drugs. That's pretty commonly known, is that they understand the chemicals in it, but as far as, like, long-term testing, they don't know. Because how could they know? They're spending all their day doing this trivial stuff, doing paperwork, doing costly stuff.
The way that all the laws are written are in favor of the hospitals doing very specific things, and as long as they do all the specific things that they're supposed to do, then their asses are covered. Like, the laws are just written in such a way to make that the case. You shouldn't be that way. Have any of the fathers here been privy to a home birth versus a hospital birth?
Two times.
Home birth. Kids were born at home, Dan?
Yeah, both kids born at home, and so was I, actually.
We attempted it with my wife, and on the third day of labor, we decided to go into the hospital and found out that she was not ever going to have that child in the home birth. But it was insane to watch the shit that they would try and push on you as a, you know, person in the hospital. Like Stephen was saying, just that, let's get everything done and you have to do everything that we say so that we can cover our butts on this and get you out of here and free that room up for somebody else. And to me, it actually ended up causing problems. I almost got in a fist fight with a nurse at the hospital because there was no emergency to push my wife into the C-section, and she needed some time emotionally to deal with the fact that just a few hours ago she was going to have a natural home birth, and now she's going
Women prepare for that natural birth versus a C-section.
Well, and she just didn't have the emotional wherewithal to deal with as quickly as this nurse wanted her to deal with the fact that, well, now you're not having a home birth, you're having a C-section, and I want you out of this room right now. Now, mind you, at no point had the doctor said that there was any risk to the child, that she wanted to lay there an hour and just get it through her system what she needed to and cope with it. Like, they'd all left us to deal with it. And 20 seconds later, this nurse pops in, are we ready to go? And I'm like, if go, you mean me throw fists at you, otherwise get the hell out of the room.
Yeah, we had similar discussions with our midwife prior to the birth both times. Basically, we were planning for what-ifs and how we would handle it, and then our midwife said that we needed to be coached, and then they would also be there to be an advocate, but we would have a birth plan to hand to the hospital and say, this is what we want. We want, you know, we've thought these through, and we want these things to be considered as first options rather than rash decisions that are forced on us, you know, like, yeah, you have to sign this right now, that kind of a thing.
And luckily, like, I'd had that conversations with, those conversations with the midwife, and I had in my head what Liz wanted. It just, when everything was said and done, it became the specifics of what she wanted. There was no way she was getting out of it without it being a surgical procedure, which was unfortunate. But it, just the way that they would try and push you through, and you have to do what they want. And legally, you can tell them, no, you're going to do what I want. I'm here. Most people won't, in the same way that you can tell a police officer, well, no, this is against the law, and this is what I'm going to do. Most people won't because they are afraid of what could happen. You know, any person in perceived authority, as you would say. But it's a...
You know our thoughts on that already.
Absolutely.
But, you know, Robert, I think you were going somewhere with the medical malpractice, and I just want to temper, Nick, what you were saying where, you know, the doctors and the nurse and the whole establishment is trying to push decisions on you guys. I did find the stat, and it's a John Hopkins study that estimates that up to 250,000 Americans die each year from medical errors.
Oh, yeah.
So it's the third leading cause of death, right behind heart disease and respiratory disease.
And, God, that must be somewhat subjective because what counts as, like, medical mispractice, right?
It's medical mistakes that can lead to death range from surgical complications that go unrecognized to mix-ups with doses or types of medications that patients receive, either the amount or mixtures that are harmful.
I imagine doctors want to try to, like, stay within their limits, but also if, like, you're a doctor that, like, knew, like, what you did would make you lose your license, would you lie about it?
Oh, yeah. There's a big incentive to...
It's just crazy. Like, are all estimates, whether it's, like, deaths related to communism, whatever, it's just all, like, underestimated because there's way too many factors that you could take into consideration. And it's like we were talking about earlier, like doctors aren't even counting people as dying from starvation. That heavily messes with the numbers. Yeah, I mean, I think a common theme was just not counting people's having been alive at all. That's a really easy one. You know, it didn't exist.
Those crazy commies.
Well, Nick, if they were using your definition, then that infant mortality rate in Cuba would be amazing, right?
Yeah, probably.
The other way around. Would they still be considered up to 6 months after birth, still be an infant death or a before being born death? Before consciousness. It'd be some new, like, category.
Yeah, no, I mean, I will say that it would make things incredibly complicated in some ways and really easy in other ways. Like, if people prescribed to what I feel. But, I mean, that's the same thing. It's trying to set at any arbitrary point. And that's the thing that I think everybody needs to realize. No matter what point you're setting, it's 100% arbitrary. You have no way to know exactly what phase of life anything is in at any point. I always just like the consciousness place because it seemed like at least a logical place to me. Versus, I mean, a bunch of cells here, a bunch of cells there. Unless you're going to go all the way back to the spark of life, which for religious reasons I understand why people do that. Doesn't make a whole lot of sense to me, but yeah, it would be a very complicated thing. But it's also, while I say that, I believe it's also a gray area in science because even what I'm saying, how can people prove that really beyond a shadow of a doubt?
And at some point, you're arguing with people who believe life starts at conception. And conception obviously means, like, that moment when that sperm and egg came together and started the reaction, per se.
Which, so statistically, doesn't happen ever, right? Because in 99.99999% of times, the sperm does not penetrate an egg because there's like hundreds of millions of sperm in one egg.
Mm-hmm.
So statistically, pregnancy doesn't happen.
I mean, in terms of calculus, yeah. That's what calculus would have you believe. Oh, we're just moving things as close as we can to zero. We never actually touch. Just a secant line becoming a tangent line. That's calculus.
And just the tip.
just the tip of the slope.
That's why I always love getting in arguments with like hardcore atheists, because they'll sit there and they'll sit on math as being this end-all be-all and trying to explain to them that it's really not much different than a Bible, as far as it's a story that approximates reality. Like, you can tell the story however you want to, and, you know, you can get better equations that are better explanations, but at the end of the day, they are still not the thing they represent and require as much faith as that guy who believes that God broke apart some dust and made a woman out of it, you know, or made man out of it and then broke off a rib and all that stuff. It's not the thing that it's supposed to be doing. It's just a way to explain the world around you. And I love throwing that in really, really zealous atheist faces. Now, mind you, I am an atheist, but I hate the ones that are all fire and brimstone about that shit. All
right, that's your cue, Robert. Tee off on that.
Well, I mean, when you mentioned the word hardcore atheist, my ears perk up. But everything you said didn't really seem to apply to me. I mean, I mean, I don't have a positive belief in God, but I think that's true of most
people. You're either a zealot or you're not. Like, that's you can be a zealot for Jesus or you can be a zealot for science.
Yeah. I mean, I think the physical world can be described scientifically for the most part, and we're getting better and better at it all the time. I don't think
no, and I agree.
The man in the sky.
Well, I'm Christian. Maybe I can jump in here. I think religion to me is completely private. I hardly ever talk about it, except with maybe a few people who ask. I guess to me it's more of like a comfort thing. Like I would rather believe, and even if it's just a belief, that what I'm doing here is going to carry on something else. And so first off, I guess, does atheism necessarily argue that there could be something after this? They're just arguing that there isn't a God. Like, for all purposes, atheists could believe that there could be an afterlife, just like no God created it. So that's one point I can make. I think it comes down to, like, what's your motivation for life? I think for me, I think I'm doing something now that has some meaning that will hopefully carry on, you know, until after I pass away, whether it's just me leaving behind a legacy. But I think about things, yeah, I guess it's like infinity versus infinity not existing, like is time infinite in that sense? And then there's another aspect I could, you know, mention. The three laws of thermodynamics. One of them is you know, energy is neither created nor destroyed, only transferred. So it's like when we're born into the world, we're not adding weight to the world, right? That's literally true.
Correct.
The world never gets heavier because of that one concept. So I think, you know,
though meteorites do strike the Earth, and that adds to the mass.
Right, but...
Well, and solar rays.
Internally in our atmosphere.
But yeah, I mean, it's not a completely closed system.
Well, I mean, isn't there supposedly some actual weight that when the spirit leaves the body does transfer out, that they had a belief that at some point? It was like
there's some beliefs that when you die, you lose, like, this really minuscule amount of weight.
It's the weight of a soul.
Yeah. If you guys have ever seen Breaking Bad, one of the main themes in that show is that back in the day, Walter White could have been a billionaire had he just stayed with that company, but he left. But him and this girl were talking about, like, they had all the chemical makeup of the whole body, and there was, like, this, like, 0.000% they couldn't figure out, and they're like, oh, maybe it's the soul. So I think even among hardcore intellectuals, there's still curiosity related to, you know, what happens after this. I think some people are saying now that, like, when you die, like, your brain still is, like, active for a long time. It's like you hear a lot of weird things. I think science is cool, but in my Christian point of view, I think science is built into the world, and that in order to believe in religion and believe in, or maybe I'm saying it backwards, but in order to do science, you have to believe that the world is orderly. you can't believe that like gravity is gonna reverse itself tomorrow. So you have to believe in universal laws that like exist. And it's like, who put the laws there? So I mean, there's a lot of ways I think about it. I have tons of friends who are atheists, so discuss
it. It's a simulation, bruh.
Yeah, maybe. I mean, if it is a simulation, that answers my question. I really don't have any motivation, you know, but that makes me sad. Come on. I feel like I'm just looking for, like, the motivation to make sense of this all. Like, why am I here? I just want to spread the message of liberty. That's what I hope my life has meaning for.
Absolutely, man.
Right on.
I'm not listening to you. You believe in science. Oh. Get that corn out of my face. That's our next movie, by the way, Nacho Libre.
It was really
Cultural Day Appropriation Day.
It was really Tom Woods who brought me over to that side, because I was kind of, you know, in between, but Tom Woods helped me realize that it was a lot of, like, the Catholic priests or the Catholic clergymen that did a lot of science, because there's always the theory is that, like, you know, religion's always been anti-science. Not necessarily true.
Not at all.
And yeah, and one thing Tom Woods points out is that when you compare, like, Christianity to Islam, Islam would not have it that the world is orderly. They imagine that the world's chaotic, and that's why, just looking at why they're kind of set back.
Actually, before you get too ahead of yourself, That is inaccurate. Because there was actually a point in history where Islam was all of science. Like they, and then eventually they kind of started moving backwards culturally, and then the Catholic Church took over with science. It's really, really interesting getting into the history of science and, like, basically, it was always...
I was just paraphrasing what Tom Woods said there, that...
You know, I don't mean to jump on you about it, just because I hate the hardcore, fanatical right-wingers that are like, oh, Islam's a backwards religion. Well, yeah, now, but there was a point in time where it was the, you know, the go-to... what's the word I'm looking for? Yeah, it was the one that was pushing the boundaries of progress in humanity, and then it kind of doubled back on itself at some point.
Well, I think Islam's definitely mischaracterized. I mean, you read Fool's Errand by Scott Horton, that unclogs your mind in a few pages, you know. And sorry to go off topic, but like one thing he points out is that a lot of these extremist terrorists are not actually religious. They're more or less... what do you call them? Like someone like they like kind of affiliate with religion for identity purposes, but they couldn't really quote anything from the Quran except maybe one like hardcore verse that would take out of context. I think a lot of the people that were involved, I think like the Orlando killer was like not that religious, but like he was Muslim. It's kind of weird. It's not exact, and there's like billions of Muslims and only like a few hundred thousand of these terrorist attacks. So proportionally, there's really not that much terrorism, but
And kind of like a tangential question, what does everybody feel about the whole Jordan Peterson thing? Because I'm always fascinated by the fact that apparently he's Catholic, but if you've ever heard him speak about religion, he speaks about it from the most academic, anthropological sense imaginable. And it's like, how can you sit there and talk about like the stories in the Bible and believe them, yet know that they existed 10,000 years before the Bible was ever written?
I don't know. JBP has been asked, like, do you believe Jesus was alive and, like, you know, died for 3 days and rose to... And the way he basically answered was just, like, I don't like phrasing my thoughts like that or something like that. I mean, he wouldn't really answer it like yes or no.
He looked to me, he almost looks at the Bible like a self-help book.
Yeah,
which is
okay.
What 12 Rules does. It's like... There's good lessons in here, whether or not it really happened. So,
yeah, I think my friend Matt described it in a good way, that he says he lives his life like there is a God. So whether you believe in God or not, you live the life like there is a God. Meaning you know, it sounds creepy thinking someone's watching you, but you know, there's something that created you and something that is wants you to do well. And doesn't, you know, didn't create you to kill others, didn't create you to rape others. Didn't create you to violate property rights of others, but in fact, the opposite.
I think some people need that, maybe. Never. I'm more from the Penn Jillette school of thought that I rape exactly as many people as I want to, and I don't need anybody telling me not to.
It's kind of Max Stirner, I think it is. Or something like that.
You know, the people will ask the question, well, if you don't believe in God, what's to stop people from killing people? And, like, well, I kill as many people as I want to, which is zero. So I see Daniel over there looking pensive at the camera.
That's just my look.
What do we let in more minutes, though, guys? Like 15 more minutes. What are we going to talk about?
Well, you know, I think it's probably as good a spot as any to start winding this thing down. We've been going about an hour, hour and a half. So this is our States of the Libertarian Union talk show. So, Nick, I'm going to direct a question at you. You talk about music. Do you do interviews with people and you talk about the type of music they like, or do you analyze songs for libertarian-style content or meaning?
Well,
sort of what we do with movies, right?
Really what my goal is, because I'll be honest, there's not much libertarian music out there. Occasionally, you know, I will have a guest on that will, you know, turn me on to something from a libertarian perspective. But I find that most people just like the music that they like. And my whole goal is really to get to know people from a human level. I would almost like look at what I do as almost like a puff piece, so to speak, you know. Find out who this person that we would look at as being like a luminary in the libertarian world, what do they think? You know, what is something that makes them just a person and not strictly speaking a libertarian? I'm only talking to libertarians because that's the people I'm interested in generally. But I also looked at it as a way to kind of point out to the rest of the world maybe that, hey, they're normal people just like you. They have normal interests. Because, like I said, you get so bogged down in the chat rooms, and it's just so much bickering and fighting and minarchists and anarchists, and everybody hates each other. I'm like, you know, I really like progressive rock. We just talk about that. That's cool. I get it. Don't want to bomb Syria. I think it's stupid. But maybe if you see me as a human being, you won't tell me to shut up and go kill myself. So, but like I said, if you have any good libertarian music you'd love to send out, I'm always looking for that stuff to promote and get out there. Other than Backwards and a few other, like Jordan Page, Tom Woods is that new guy, Rock Gut Country, that's got some stuff out. Then there's Rush, but even Rush, like as an artist, Neil Peart's kind of turned his back on the whole libertarian ideology. Became a former Randian as opposed to a Randian.
Did not know that. I just heard that they retired recently or stopped touring or something.
I'm glad I didn't go to the last tour because it would have been sad to watch. I've seen a couple videos, and as a vocalist myself, it's difficult watching people get old and no longer have it. And Geddy Lee didn't have it, we'll just say that. Couldn't get those notes out quite anymore.
Yeah, it is sad. We all get old, though. My wife was telling me the other night that I'm getting a lot of gray hair. I can't see it, cause, like, on the top of my head. And by the way, I have a headband in, like one of my kids' headbands, because my hair is growing out, and it's getting my eyes. So I have to appropriate some girls' headwear.
Yeah, so if any of you guys do want to come out and nerd out and just talk about stuff that's not politics for a change, I'm the guy to do it.
I have no interest. I never not talk about politics. I don't even talk to people not about politics. So.
I managed to talk to Trey Weaver for like an hour and a half or something like that.
Oh, yeah, and I love that guy.
We're already planning our, like, I think me and him were talking, we're going to be doing a special 4th of July episode. Every episode that ends in a one, we do a, what do you call it, 5 albums that everyone should know or you should go out and buy right now. And we're going to do a special 4th of July themed one and pick albums that I think we're going to go pick the worst albums for like jingoism and Americanism and all that stuff.
Put
sit there and tear them apart.
Song on there. America, fuck yeah.
I mean, that may be how we open up the episode, honestly.
That's how we opened up our 4th of July one last year with Adam Kokesh. I think it was episode, I'm going to say 30. Does that sound right, Robert?
I was talking to that guy.
You need to get back in touch with that guy, Dan. He's been going around with his tour bus. He's been trolling Bill Weld. He's been doing all sorts of stuff. I watch his Adam versus the Man on YouTube sometimes.
I got to ask you, how do you think he did, Steven, against Bill Weld? I was a little underwhelmed, personally.
Oh, that last video?
Yeah.
I thought Bill would actually stood his ground. Like, Adam was trying to, you know, go in and, like, have these, like, one-shot questions, and, like, Bill Weld, like, had answers to them. So I think it made, I think it made Adam look a little weak in that sense, because it's just like, you know, Adam's just trying to, like I don't believe Bill Weld at all. Bill Weld says he's always thought taxation is theft. No, he hasn't. I mean, just go listen to what Bill Weld used to say. So, I mean, Bill Weld kind of turns his back on what he, that'd be good if Bill Weld got better. I just don't believe it. Do any of you guys believe that Bill Weld got better?
Oh, no, he's a shill.
I don't think he's mean. I don't think Gary Johnson's mean. I just think they're both kind of traitors to the party. I mean, especially Walt sold out to Gary, which is like, you know, we need to support Hillary to beat Trump. And I still think Trump would have been better than Hillary. Hillary would have just. I don't think we would have had this North Korea, South Korea coming together if Hillary
definitely
was in power, because Hillary would have started another war elsewhere already. People think Trump's a warmonger. Well, Hillary would have just done it quicker. She's an expert on war.
Do Daniel and Robert subscribe much to the party politics at all? I get the impression no from what I've heard of the show, but
no, not at all.
No, yeah, that's a big no from me.
I think that there's.
We had. But we even had Kokesh ask us to get involved in his campaign, and I was like, nah.
Good for you guys. Real principled.
We're the thinnest.
I think there's room for it from an educational standpoint, and there's a platform there, but I don't believe in voting and trying to subjugate others to my will by pushing a button or checking a box. You know.
But what if my will, Dan, was just to leave you be? And all I wanted to do was just get in office and leave you be.
You shouldn't need to be in office to do that.
Hey, that's not an argument. Hold up. I mean, I think I'm going to support the Mises Caucus and maybe Larry Sharp, but other than that, I mean, there's no one else I could really, really support. I think Larry Sharp, even, he's only been a libertarian for like 5-6 years. I'm impressed with him. Like, he's made a lot of progress. He's pretty good, but I hope we can get Star Wars out.
He's the best voice that the party actually has.
Yeah.
Because he's actually good at the political side of things, but
he's a well-spoken
very
guy.
Very principled.
Yeah, he's not the kind of guy that's going to get involved in scandals, and you can tell. The media would, like, really have to try to, like, he's just a nice, well-spoken guy. But anyways, I mean, it's just obviously not really anyone else I would support. And the only reason I would support anybody is because if we can at least get someone in the Libertarian Party who, like, is a better messenger. Like, I don't know if you guys, I'm an LP card member. I get email from the LP. Most of them suck. Like, they're just the worst marketers ever. Like, it's either, like, asking for money or supporting some candidate no one's ever heard of that's probably a Bill Weld type libertarian.
Were you in the worst caucus ever. When I posted that about Tom Woods should write their emails?
Oh, no. Oh, my God. That's a good one, man.
No, because like you said, man, they're the single worst asking for money emails I've ever gotten in my life, and I get one a day.
I got a freaking letter in the mail the other day saying, like, hey, this is really important. We really, really, really need your money right now. I was basically had the letter, like, we're, like, in a dire situation right now. Things are happening at this convention. Need your money. And there's like a checkbox for, like, $5,000. Like, you know, they're hoping someone... I mean, I don't like being asked for money. I don't mind supporting people, but don't ask you for money.
My big thing with the Mises Caucus and why I got involved is because at least if there's going to be a party that's carrying the mantle of libertarian out there, it better damn well be principled. And the fact that there's so many communists involved in the Libertarian Party is mind-boggling. And I really don't want those people carrying the name libertarian. And
exactly.
Me
that's why I try to ostracize people. Like, when I see, like, these people that are LP chairmen for the LP and they don't understand what domestication of animals is and why that saves animals. There's, like, little basic stuff, you know, that they just don't understand anything. I try to ostracize them in that. They're either, one, going to listen to what I say and go read some stuff, or they'll just shut up and go away. But honestly, wouldn't it be better if just some people just shut up and go away? How else do we get them to do that? Unless you just make fun of them, like, make them feel bad. Literally, just try to make them feel bad on the inside so they don't waste anyone else's time. But I think it's a little bit, I think it's a little bit unfair. I truly, truly, truly think it's unfair that libertarianism is such a sound ideology, at the core of it is just keeping to yourself, living freely, cooperating with other people. It's really, really basic. But for these people to warp the ideology so much, I just kind of want them to feel bad deep inside, because they should feel bad. If you're wondering, like, why am I so mean to people? Because I want them to go away. There are plenty of good libertarians. So, like, for every shitty libertarian on my friends list, probably, like, 500 good ones. You know, not too many terrible ones, but...
But that's my problem with the LP, though, is all it does is attract the shitty libertarians.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying.
What kind of confused message is it where it's like, yeah, the government's terrible, elect me to run it?
And this freaking used car salesman, Sarwark, I mean, he couldn't sell anything to anyone, but he probably didn't sell many cars.
From what I understand, he actually is a pretty good car salesman, but certainly not a message of liberty.
Well, the way people prop him up and, like, trying to defend him, it's, like, the worst way is, like, oh, he's good at organizing events. He's good at organizing events. He just couldn't really describe libertarianism in three sentences or less. He can set up an event, set up a nice snack bar, set it up so it looks nice. I mean, you know, great job, Nick. Great job. That's really what we need is just a better party.
I'd like to see less events and more hackers.
Oh, yeah. I mean, we don't need events. We need people to, like...
That's my big thing with, like, the Libertarian Party asks me for money. I'm like, well, why do you ask me to do something as opposed to asking me for money? Why don't you take advantage of the skills I have? We're never going to outpay any of the other parties. So you might as well, like, just get the skills that we have and utilize those.
And every dollar someone has that they didn't work for, they're more willing to spend rather than save. It's just kind of the way it is. Like, if you're given something, like, you have automatically, you're going to have a less chance of saving that.
All right, guys. I think that we've gone off the rails. It's great. I love it. But we've been going about an hour and a half. Steven, you said you had to go 15 minutes, about 20 minutes ago.
I just want to try this effects thing. Do you hear the effects on now?
Yeah, let's hear some effects.
I was going to try some effects. Let me see.
Here I am trying to wind the show down
one,
for your
two,
benefit.
Three. Testing. Do you hear it?
A little bit.
Okay. I'll mess with that someday, but yeah, I guess we can end now, Dan, sure.
All right.
You are a huge nerd.
All right, so I got my effects going. So I'll just mention where you guys can find our show. It's the Actual Anarchy Podcast, actualanarchy.com, and we also have the normie friendly version, lastnighters.com. So do check that out. We also run readrothbard.com, blackanddoggold, and a few other websites. Robert, is your website up yet?
No, it isn't. But thanks for remembering.
But it will be. It will be at some point. And Robert also has some T-shirt designs on, is it Teespring?
TeePublic.
And I've got a link to that in each of our most recent episodes under actualanarchy.com/podcast. So go about halfway down the page, and you'll see some of Robert's designs. You can click through and make a purchase if you desire. And we'll go to Steven. Where can people find your work? And then we'll go to Nick.
Y'all can find me at forpeaceandliberty.com or just look me up, man.
All right.
I just wanted to leave an awkward pause there. Don't edit it out. It's an awkward pause. Just look me up.
More awkward pausing. Anyways, yeah.
Words. No, yeah. Thanks for having me on for this. So we do this like once a month, and hopefully get more people on next time.
Yeah, once a month, and usually it's, you know, six or seven people. I think the first or second time we had almost 9 or 10 people, and it was like too much. It was like overwhelming. No one could really say more than a minute worth of content, and then they had to wait like a half an hour to speak again.
Six, one person with the echo out of 10.
Yeah, there you go. All right, Nick, where can people find your show?
SoundsLikeLibertyPodcast.com, or just look up Sounds Like Liberty on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, pretty much everywhere. I post the video of the audio.
What's Cam4?
What's Cam4? Really, I need to look for it. I'm hoping it's
no,
porn.
You don't.
It's Cam porn, right?
I don't know. You got to look for it now.
I'm going to. I will post
it.
I don't care what it is.
If you can get on Cam4,
I hope
I'll
it's a dating site.
Sort of.
But yeah, so sounds like Liberty. Yeah. We're all over the place.
I'm just messing around. Sorry.
All right. And Robert, do you have any final messages for our audience before we bring this to a close?
No, just thanks for listening, guys. It's been a privilege, honor, talking to these two fine gentlemen from their respective podcasts, part of the Libertarian Union. And, yeah, join us back next month for another hot episode. We don't know what we'll be talking about, but it'll be spicy.
That's right. And you can find more content from our other providers at libertarianunion.com. We've got Don't Waste Your Hate, Liberty Weekly, Subversion Webcast, Foreign Policy Focus, Battle for Liberty, ANCAP Barbershop, among others. There's so many I can't even remember them all.
Hold on. We have a show called ANCAP Barbershop.
That's great, right?
Who is this? Yeah. Like, I've been out of the loop, obviously.
Well, go to the Libertarian Union. You'll find out all about it. LibertarianUnion.com.
I will go check out the union I am part of.
All right. And we'll /.com all day long. Saying goodnight from the State of the Libertarian Union episode for the month of April 2018. And we'll see you guys in a month. Thank you guys for joining. It's been a pleasure.
Peace.
I thank you guys very much for having me on.
In the early days of the internet, radical libertarians were scattered, lonely, and faceless. Without direction, they resigned to scour the web, sifting through content providers in a wasteland plagued by YouTube demonetization, Facebook jail, and covert internet censorship. But then, in 2017, the Libertarian Union was formed. Finally, the average Joe libertarian could find a thriving community of independent podcasters and content providers, all in one convenient location. At Libertarian Union, we'll always have the latest news, interviews, discussions, and even movie reviews. With hundreds of episodes and more added all the time, you'll always find something fresh at LibertarianUnion.com.
Hey everyone, please like, follow, donate, subscribe, and share. Any donations will be used to reach more people.